Perfect. Okay, back on the record, June 3rd, 2025, 1 o'clock p.m. The Silverview appeals. Mr. Schutz just commencing cross-examination of Dr. Cook. So go ahead, Mr. Schutz.
Excuse me. Sorry, Mr. Examiner. Just may I do a couple housekeeping things? I just wanted to note, I had mentioned some issues with Mr. Wright's availability, Chris Wright of Radke. I have more specific information. He is available tomorrow morning from 9 to 11. I'll just ask that we may bear that in mind as we go along, depending on how long all the other witnesses take. I wanted to alert you that the county may call Steve Heacock as a witness. After all, I had mentioned two witnesses. He may be a third. That's contingent again on how some things go. And I wanted to request one of the members of our team has an appointment this evening they're trying to make, and I'm hoping we could do a hard stop at 4:45. I'll put that out there, and just if it's possible,
okay.
I would appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, it's I don't know if we can get Mr. Wright's testimony done in 2 hours, so we probably should just maybe start with him at 2 o'clock today. Well, once we're done with Dr. Cook, maybe. Does that work with everybody? Just to make sure we get him in, would that be a problem, Ms. Clungeon?
What I would say is he can be back after the noon hour tomorrow, but he has a problem at 11 a.m. that keeps
oh,
him.
It's just at 11. Okay. All right. Got you. Okay. Then we can, we can certainly work with that. Okay. All right.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. No problem on the 4:45. So go ahead, Mr. Schutz.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. And good afternoon, Dr. Cook. Nice to see you again. So you mentioned that you had GPS data, but you didn't provide that in your reports, correct?
Correct.
And that's the 2020 report or the 2023 report?
Correct. I believe my information was available both times, but yes. Yeah, I was just stating that I had done a wetland verification. And then I showed my data points as a map, but it's not my task as a reviewer to give out all the data.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to keep this. I don't think it's going to take too long. I want to keep it short. The point is, you didn't include it with your reports, correct?
No.
Okay. And you didn't provide that data with your remand report for this remand hearing either, correct?
Correct.
Okay. You didn't provide coordinates in your reports, your data sheets either, did you?
No, I did not. Okay.
So is there anything in the record that shows this GPS data?
As to the location other than and then the maps that I included in my report, no.
Okay, so but the maps show that GPS data?
No, the maps show the location on the aerial. They do not give the data.
No, I'm sorry, I asked that incorrectly. Are the maps consistent with your GPS data? Are the locations on consistent with your GPS data?
They are.
Okay. So you went to the site in 2022 and did work. The purpose of that was to critique wetland work that had been done by SoundView. Is that accurate?
2020, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Correct. 2020. You provided a report and you provided a map, but no GPS?
Correct.
Okay. But it's your contention that it's the fault of the applicant for not reaching out and getting that GPS data?
Yes, all they needed to do was ask, and I stated that in previous hearings.
But you didn't think that was something that it would be good to provide at any point in the 5 years that this has been going on?
If they had wanted it, I would have provided it. No, I'm just a reviewer. I am not someone who was tasked by any client to do a full delineation. So no,
right.
It is not something that is typically provided by a reviewer.
It's not, so GPS data is not something that's typically
nope.
provided by a reviewer?
Nope, absolutely not. Had they asked for it, I had stated previously that I would supply it, but they never asked.
When did you state that?
Both in the 2023 hearing, I believe. I'd have to go back and look at the record.
Okay. So you were aware of the condition that required them to go out and test next to your spots?
Yes.
Okay, but you didn't think it would be helpful to provide GPS data?
No, because they had their own and they had my map, and all they had to do was look for the veg.
Okay,
And
so
that's
let's
what I
talk.
would have done.
Right, so let's talk about the map, because the condition says dig test pits alongside your test pits as de designated on the map. And I think you just testified that the spots on the map were consistent with your GPS data, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so Phil Scholes testified today that even without the GPS data, they were able to locate the locations of the spots on the map within, several feet. Did you hear that testimony?
I did, but I disagreed with it because they didn't find the same vegetation communities, so they obviously weren't in the same location.
Okay, so he went on, he did that. He went to the, he testified that he was able to locate within a couple, several feet of locations on the map. And then he walked around 10 feet diameter, or circumference or whatever the term is, and didn't find any vegetation. So you think they weren't even close to the location on the map? That's your contention?
Yes, I think that's correct because reed canary grass is very obvious.
That's okay.
They're very first thing, and reed canary grass comes in monoculture, and they did a plot that had no resemblance to the monoculture reed canary grass of the first point.
No, I understand that that's your testimony. So what you're saying is that they were at least 10 feet away as far as the location as to where you mapped it.
No, I'm not saying that at all. That you're putting words into my mouth. That's an
Well,
incorrect statement.
if they were on the ground, you think that they erred so much in locating the map point, the data point as shown on the map, that they were at least 10 feet away from where your actual, where the map data point is. Because otherwise, if they walked 10 feet in circumference and didn't find the vegetation, then they must have been that far off from the map location. Is that your testimony?
No, that's not my testimony. That's you're putting words into Mr. Skoll's mouth. That's not my testimony. They weren't at least 10 feet away. I have no idea where they were, but they weren't at the same location as my data points.
But you'd have to say that if just for the sake of argument, if Mr. Scholes was testifying truthfully that he believed he was within several feet of the data point on your map, which you've testified is consistent with your GPS location, and he walked 10 feet around that location and did not find your vegetation, then you're saying that they were at least 10 feet off from the point on the map. Am
No,
I?
that's not what I'm saying, because I have no idea where they did. Phil knows reed canary grass, and that's the for the just for example, the first plot. He knows what reed canary grass is, and he didn't sample in a patch of reed canary grass. So he clearly wasn't where my point was. I have no idea where they sampled. I have no idea if they actually measured out 2, 3, 10 feet from where they thought the data point was. So I don't know what they did on the ground, but that is not my testimony. That's what you're saying, but that's not my testimony.
That's what Mr. Scholes has testified he did. Do you have any reason to disagree with what he did on
Yes,
remote?
because he clearly didn't sample where my point was.
No, I'm not asking that. I'm
I have
asking.
sub-meter accuracy GPS, so I don't know what the problem was, but again, if we wanted to resolve this, I can send my GPS data points. I do have them. I verified on my GPS unit. They're all still there.
So there's some discrepancy with the location on the map, it seems like, and where you dug. Because otherwise, if Soundview and Phil Scholes were at the location as shown on your map, and they walked 10 feet around and didn't find the vegetation, then isn't it possible that the location on the map was incorrect?
No,
So
because the map was generated by my GPS points on a GIS program. So no. So you're stating that Phil Scholes is right and I'm not right, and that's not how this works.
well,
Phil
I'm
thinks
just.
he was where he was, and I have a GPS map to sub-meter accuracy.
That you
So
didn't get
what I
situation.
contend is, had he gone out to approximately where my point was, had he had the GPS units and looked for a reed canary grass patch and sampled in that, just for the first one, and sampled in that reed canary grass patch, he would have been able to be closer. But he didn't do that. They didn't
So
do
your
that.
testimony is that you geo-referenced the base map or aerial that you overlaid your GPS data on?
No, I didn't overlay it. The GIS program sucks in the GPS data and generates a map. I didn't overlay it. That's not how the technology works. It uses the coordinates, overlays it on the program, the GIS program overlays it onto an aerial photograph and geo-references it and creates the map.
Okay. So you wouldn't dig in an inappropriate spot on purpose. You would never do that, right?
I do the sample point. I take a
No,
GPS.
I'm just asking a simple question. You personally would never inappropriately dig in a spot that you knew was not, on purpose to be outside of a wetland or inside of a wetland, as the case may be.
But
I
that's
mean, your
how you do
reputation.
delineation. You go from wet upland into wetland. So
Yeah,
I
no,
guess.
I'm not asking that. I'm saying, I mean, you value your reputation, correct?
Correct.
Okay. It's important with regard to your interaction with agencies and just in your profession generally, right?
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, Rachel Hyland is a reputable member of the profession, a soil scientist. Phil is, the hearing examiner's found that he has been is credible. Is it your contention that they, have misrepresented their data or intentionally dug in the wrong locations? Because it sounded like that was what you were implying during your direct.
I think that they have been taking data points in uplands.
On purpose.
I don't know what their motivation is, but I think that's what they've been doing. Yes. It's very clear, especially in October, where the wetland is, and they did not sample in the wetland, or if they did, which Rachel did, where I felt that their data points did indicate that she found wetlands, even though they said they didn't. So they did dig in the October sampling in wetlands and found wetlands. They just represented it as not wetlands for whatever reason. Because the soils clearly were hydric, just based solely on the color. And they
So
already indicated that the vegetation and the hydrology were present.
they were intentionally misrepresenting.
I don't know if it was intentional or if Rachel just doesn't know that the definition of a hydric soil is a crowbar of one or two with models, but their own data shows that it's wetlands. So I don't know. I can't begin to say what the motivation was. If it was, I don't know, but the data clearly shows that it was wetlands.
So when was the
The
last
points
time
that
you
they
were on the
did
property?
in October.
I understand that's your testimony. When was the last time you were on the property?
2020.
2020. And you haven't been on the property since.
No, I
Okay. And
have
all
not.
the a lot of test pits dug during that time, but none of them are yours. But during that time, last time you were there was 2020. I just want to make sure that's clear.
Yes.
I think that's all I have. Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Wachter.
Good afternoon, Dr. Cook. My name is Neil Wachter. I represent Kitsap County on this matter, and I don't believe we've ever had the opportunity to speak. I had a few follow-up questions for you, and I hope I don't cover too much ground that was covered in the previous examinations or in previous hearings. You just testified that you were last on the property in 2020. Was that September of 2020?
Yes, September 24th, according to my data.
And I believe you also testified that there had been some amount of precipitation that had occurred in the days or weeks preceding your visit. Is that correct?
Correct. The fall rains had started.
And approximately how many days before September 24th had the fall rains begun?
I'd have to go back. I would have known that back in 2023, but it's not something that I recollect at the moment. But it had rained the day before I got there, because the vegetation was wet, and I did look at photos, so clearly it had rained recently to my site visit.
You said the vegetation was wet. Was it muddy out?
There were a couple of spots that were muddy from my recollection, and I think I saw a photo that showed some mud, yes.
It isn't dewfall a reasonable explanation for it being moist out or for the vegetation being moist, like you've just described?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of that question?
Isn't the dewfall a reasonable explanation for why the vegetation might be wet when you were out in September of 2020?
Dew is really only an issue first thing in the morning, and I was out until 5 or 6 p.m. So that wouldn't have been an issue, kind of after probably 10 or 11 in the morning.
Okay. Bear with me. I have a lot of notes to try and scramble through. Did you go onto the property on more than one date in September of 2020?
No, I was there the entire day, just the one day.
I wondered about the piezometer. You testified, or at least suggested, that there could have been piezometers set up on the premises. What data would you expect to receive from piezometer readings?
Actually, Diana Hennessy from the Department of Ecology had suggested it in one of her letters to the county, that a piezometer study be performed, and the data that you would collect would be where the groundwater elevation was in the soil profile. And then with the soil texture, you can extrapolate where the zone of influence is, which means that in very fine-grained soils like silts and clays, and these are loams, so there's a large component of silt and probably also some of clay. By capillary action, it actually rises water influence above the groundwater. So you look at both of those. But that's what you would find out is where the groundwater elevation would be, and then figure out the zone of influence.
And Diane Hennessy was with the Department of Ecology, is that right?
That's correct.
And she's no longer with the department, is that also right?
Correct.
How long has she been not employed by the Department of Ecology?
She left the wetlands unit within a week of the site visit with these folks, because she had a disagreement with the lead who went out in the field with them. So she went and was adjunct from ecology with the Department of Transportation, I believe. Might have been the EPA for a couple of years. And at this point, I believe she's a private consultant.
She left the Department of Ecology within a week of a site visit with SoundView to this very location. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, there was a multi-agency site visit with SoundView. I believe Mr. Scholes was there too. I don't know if Steve Hecock was there. And her and a fellow named Molstad, who was the soil scientist for ecology and the lead of the Bellevue section of ecology. And they had a field site visit because there was an inability to agree on the wetland conditions out there.
And
And
what
as a result of that site visit, she transferred out of ecology.
would that have been a Neil Molstad? Is that correct?
Yes, Neil Most.
NEAL. Okay.
Yep.
What year was that?
It's in my one of my reports. I believe that was in 2020, but I had have to look at some of my old reports. Yeah, I've got so many files on this project. It's not something I can find e quite right at my fingertips. I haven't loaded it for this hearing, so.
Well, fair enough. But as best you recall, it was it would have been in 2020 or so.
Yeah, it was well before the 2023 hearing, so yeah.
So are you aware that following Diane Hennessy's visit that you just described, the Washington Department of Ecology has issued a notice of concurrence with the wetland delineation for the site.
Yes, and you should also be aware that Diane Hennessy wrote a memo or a letter after that concurrence was done, saying that she disagreed with the call by her lead.
Is that letter or memo in the record?
I believe it is, yes.
Do you think Diane Hennessy, or do you know whether Diane Hennessy suffered some disciplinary consequence as a result of this disagreement that you described between her and other DOE personnel out on the site during a site visit?
No, as far as I know, she did not.
Is it a usual practice to delineate wetland boundaries where one or more of the wetland parameters are absent?
Not unless you're in a using the problematic methodology, no. You typically need all three unless it's an area where one or more of the criteria are missing because of things like plowing or some kind of disturbance. So typically in a typical situation, no, you have to have all three.
Now, you testified about plowing, and if I got this right, you believed that there had been some amount of plowing on this on the subject property. Is that right?
Yes, and in fact, Mr. Scholes agreed with that. He his statement was that because it happened so long ago, it was no longer salient. But that's true with respect to things like colors, etc. But with respect to elevations of soil, the different layers, this different horizons in the profile, that doesn't change. It's not going to change. So, yes.
So,
And Miss Hennessy, Diane Hennessy, well, excuse me a second, sorry, also identified, and so did Mr. Molstad while they were in the field, that they saw evidence of plowing.
I take it from your answer that the disagreement between Ms. Hennessy and Mr. Molstad was certainly not concerning the issue of plowing. Is that fair?
It wasn't Mr. Molstad that she had the disagreement with. It was the lead of the wetlands section, who is not a wetlands person. He runs the wetlands section for the Bellevue Office of Ecology, or he did. I don't know if he's still there, but he did not have any wetlands expertise. Their disagreement was over a bunch of things that were being discussed in the field with respect to hydrology presence and soils, etc. And Mr. DeCaro, who was with SVC, he's not part of this hearing, but he's with SVC and was part of that effort. I guess I believe it was in 2020, was arguing with her in the field, and there were a bunch of disagreements about different criteria that was either seen or by the ecology staff and not seen by SVC staff and Mr. Scholes. So there was the, she discusses in her letter, that she wrote disagreeing with the call to agree to the 355 square feet, that some of the conditions. And her field notes, where she also talks about the disagreements, is also part of the record from a previous hearing.
Okay. And you were there for this particular?
No.
No,
I wasn't invited.
Were you ever on the premises at the same time as Diane Hennessy?
No, I was not.
Okay. Were you ever on the premises the same time as Neil? I'm sorry, his last name just slipped me.
Malstead.
Malstead, thank you.
No, she brought him to that multi-party site visit.
Okay.
That was the only time that he was involved, because she wanted some backup, because there had been previous disagreements about the soils.
I want to ask you a little bit about hydrophytic vegetation. First, just for background, what exactly does that mean?
It's plants that are adapted to living in saturated or flooded conditions, and they develop morphological features that morphological features that help them adapt, or they just persist in wetter areas.
Okay.
And their affinity to how wet it is what those indicators that we were discussing earlier for. So there's upland, there's facultative, which means that 30 to 60% of the time you find those species, they're found in wetlands. There's fac-wet species, which means 60 to 90% of the time you find those species, they're found in wetlands. And then there's obligate. So they're established there, how wet their affinity is.
Okay. So is it correct to say that you believe this site predominantly contains vegetation that is considered to be hydrophytic?
I think that there are a lot of hydrophytic plants that are found just outside the wetland, and as a result of the fact that the meadow was hydroseeded by the farmer. So there are hydrophytic plants outside the wetland boundary, yes. But
and
it's there's more upland plants in most of that area than there are hydric plants, although there were some areas where I found a predominance of hydrophytic plants, meaning more than 50% aerial cover, where the soils and the hydrology were not present. They were not doing very well, I'll also say that. So in September, for example, I talked about the veg outside the wetland being brown. There was, especially in the reed canary grass patch extended outside the wetland boundary, but the reed canary grass growing in the wetland was still green, whereas the reed canary grass growing outside of the wetland had turned brown by September when I was out.
Can you think of any reason that the reed canary species would not have been present during the subsequent visits that you've heard about to the subject property?
No, it's so robust and so invasive that it's real. I mean, we have whole conferences where people talk about trying to get rid of it. It is incredibly invasive species. And once it's established itself in an area, it's really difficult, short of flooding an area consistently for years, to get rid of it. It's really hard to get rid of it. So no, I can't think of a reason.
You mentioned hydroseeding. Why, what is the source of your information about practices of hydroseeding that may have taken place?
It came from Mr. Best, the neighbor. He witnessed, he's been the previous owner's neighbor for decades, and he said he used to watch him plow and seed the meadow. And if you look at the mixture in the meadow, it's a classic farmer hydroseed mix for the Pacific Northwest, the species that are present. And most of them are not native, so that's the main way they would have gotten into that meadow.
Any idea what time frame Mr. Best was speaking of?
As Mr. Scholl said, he thought that the plowing had happened approximately 30 years prior. And I think when I looked at the aerial photos, I was saying it was between 20 to 30 years since it had been farmed, just based on aerial. So I don't have an exact estimate. We'd need to talk to the previous owner or Mr. Best if he was able to recollect and tie it to a specific time frame, but that would be my guess. It was a long time ago.
Were there locations of a former chicken coop on the premises while you were there?
I found one when I was accessing the site, yeah. And they also used to roost in one of the barn buildings. But it wasn't out in the meadow, it was closer to the house. It was underneath all the blackberries.
And I just want to verify, you have not personally been to the premises since September of 2020, is that right?
That's correct.
Have
I
you
haven't.
sent anyone, or has anyone visited on your behalf to the subject property since that time?
No, the only thing I've had that I've done is ask Mr. Best to go look at that south property edge north of his driveway, south of the. So that's the only thing I've asked anybody to do.
Did you ever ask Mr. Best to look for the evidence of a ditch at the southern edge of the subject property?
There is a ditch at the southern edge of the subject property. It goes along Mickleberry Road.
And that's proximate to the southwest wetland area that you studied. Is that correct?
It's on the corner of it, yeah, and then heads north while the driveway of Mr. Best is adjacent to the southern property boundary. So it's on that corner, yes. And then the ditch continues south.
My understanding of the remand is that hydrology was not a focus of the remand. The remand was tailored to address the issue of hydric soil. You've testified a fair amount about hydrology. Why do you believe that's important to understand as we consider issues of hydric soil?
As Mr. Scholl said, as a wetlands person, we are required to look at three criteria for delineating wetlands, and limiting yourself to a single criteria is not science. It's not best available science. So we need to look at all three being present. And, the fact that when they were out in May and July multiple times, they didn't find hydrology, whereas in October, SVC did find hydrology, explains exactly why this is important. Because you would not have the soil colors that we're finding and the hydric vegetation if you didn't have hydrology present. And the fact that this is a meadow and it's groundwater fed, and the groundwater does not stay at an elevation high enough for the areas just peripheral to the wetland to be present indicates that it is a very important. Without water, you don't have wetlands. So it's absolutely crucial. And I believe the hearing examiner clarified for everybody that although in the remand it did talk about the A11, that wasn't his intent to limit it solely to that. And so Mr. Scholes and I both recognize that you can't do wetlands work without looking at all three criteria. So hydrology is important.
Okay, the last area of my questioning kind of takes me to the first things that you said. When you started testifying, you sort of had an opening statement and it was not a question and answer format. That makes it difficult to track everything that gets said because narratives, I'm as guilty as the next person of providing a narrative that goes on and on, can sometimes provide a lot of information all in one quick span. You testify that there seems to be a perception that I'm not a qualified wetlands scientist.
Soil scientist.
Okay. Fair. I may have mistyped that. And I'm not here to ask you to present more evidence of your qualifications. I just wondered, why do you believe there's such a perception?
Because at the last two hearings, it appeared that the reason that the A11 indicator came out was Mr. Scholes stated that I incorrectly identified the A11 criteria, and it was part of the remand. So clearly, the hearing examiner was believing Mr. Scholes, and that's why he asked them to go back out and look. And the fact that the only consultant of all the people who've been out in that property that was asked to testify today was Mr. Scholes, despite the fact that Mr. DeCaro and Rachel Hyland and the others, you were not even going to ask for the county expert to come out, or Mr. Schultz wasn't. Or no, I guess it was you. We're not going to even ask the Steve Heacock to come out. Indicates to me that there is a lot of credence put on Mr. Scholes' testimony, and I just needed everybody to understand that just because Mr. Scholes and I disagree, it's not a matter of the details, it's a matter of where the sampling was done. I think either of us would have come up with the same answers. I look at their data sheets and I'm not questioning, other than their call on the hydric soils when the chroma was one or two with models. I believe everything on their data sheets. I just think they're sampling in the wrong location. So that's why I needed to clarify that I am qualified, because previously I hadn't emphasized my soil expertise, but I needed to everyone to know that I teach just as many have over the years taught just as many classes on hydric soils as Mr. Scholes has, and I've been author of the hydric, or I was one of the major reviewers of the hydric soils handbook for Washington, and you know, and I have a PhD in soils, so you know, it's important for people to understand, even though I didn't emphasize that last time, that now that for some reason we're overemphasizing the importance of the soils, that I am qualified to discuss and review soils.
Thank you. Those are all.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Cook. I don't have any other questions for you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wachter. Mr. Schutz, any redirect?
Yes.
No. Sorry, I thought you said.
Sorry, yeah, I got that backwards. Yeah, Mr. Clungeon, yes, any redirect? Go ahead.
Not a lot, just a little bit. Dr. Cook, I believe Mr. Schutz asked you about, you know, he asked you questions about whether you provided the GPS data in any of your reports or materials. Is it common to provide that data in a report?
Never.
Okay.
No, I mean, even if I'm submitting a report as the main delineator, I don't give a table. Nobody does. Nobody includes a table of the data at the end. And on the data sheets, I didn't give the exact data because, again, I was just acting as a as a third party reviewer. So I've never seen as a third party reviewer somebody including the GPS data. You certainly could, and now that it's been mentioned, I suppose I will in the future for my third party reviews, but no, I don't typically do that. But again, all they had to do was ask. I have it. I just and I verified on my GPS unit, I still have it, so I can provide it. And I would have, because it would have alleviated a lot of the issues for this latest work, because we would have known that they were in the same location instead of, trying to guess that they just by virtue of the veg that they weren't in the same location and the soils that they weren't in the same location. Everybody would have been working from an equivalent point, and it would have made a lot more sense and wasted a lot less time on this hearing. But that didn't happen, so here we are.
And then he inquired about, whether the map was consistent with your GPS data, and you indicated that it generally was. Is
Not
there,
generally. It's
or that it was?
exactly.
Okay.
The GPS data goes into a GIS program, and the GIS program generates the map on top of an aerial photograph that's georeferenced.
I see.
Yeah, so.
Okay. For the map and the data, could there be a few feet of difference?
Yeah, these GPS units, mine's considered sub-meter, so it could be off by 2 or 3 feet. Typically, in wet meadows, if there's no overcast and the day I was out, it was clear. You get really good accuracy. If it's a forested cover, whatever, and it's a cloud cover, it can be off by more than 3 feet. But yeah, typically the accuracy is quite good.
Okay. And just to clarify, a few feet does matter for a wetland delineation, right? You can, but in the span of a few feet can make all the difference for whether it's upland or wetland, correct?
Yep, and as I said, a wetland boundary is a line, and on one side of the line is a wetland, and on the other side of the line is upland, and it could be within inches. So yes, a few feet can matter.
Right. And then just in Mr. Wachter's, he asked about the ditch on the south part of the site. And I just wanted to clarify because I wasn't sure, because previously you testified that there wasn't a ditch on the south property line, that it was, but then in the description, you kind of described something going from north to south. So would it be more accurate to say there's a ditch on the west property line? Is
Correct.
that okay?
Yeah. The ditch intersects the property right at that southwest corner, and
Okay.
there is not a ditch along the southern property boundary,
Okay.
along the best driveway. There's no ditch. It's level and then goes up into the blackberries. Elevationally, the veg, is up 6 feet plus. But there is no ditch there. It's only on that very corner.
Right. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cook. Very helpful as always. All right, Ms. Clungeon, next witness. Is that Mr. Adams?
Yes, it is. All right, give me one
Bring him
second.
up, Ms.
I'm
Jones.
over.
There. Oh, there he is. Okay. All right. Welcome back, Mr. Adams. Let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. You swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Ms. Clungeon.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Adams. All right. I know we've done this a few times before, but just as a little reminder, could you remind the examiner and everyone here a bit about your professional background?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. My name's John Adams. I am a licensed architect here in Washington State. I have an NCARB certification as well as a member of the American Institute of Architects. I received my undergraduate degree from the University of Pennsylvania in architecture and landscape design. And then I went on to receive my master's degree from the University of Michigan in architecture. I've been working, I started my career in New York City with the Staten Island Ferry Terminal project, which was over New York Harbor, as well as the Brooklyn Battery Underpass and two subway tunnels. So we had definite restrictions on how deep the foundation could go on that site. That was a number of years ago, about closing in on 25, 30 years now at this point. And then moved to Seattle. I have done several projects over structured parking in that time as an architect, and some of them again over extremely tight earthwork conditions, such as the Salmon Bay building, which I worked on when at a previous firm, where we are on a hazardous waste site next to Salmon Bay, and that the foundation had to be extraordinarily shallow in order to achieve that project. For the last 11 years, I'm the principal and owner with my partner of Adams Architecture in Seattle.
Okay. And in addition to having to design things with kind of shallow foundations, do you have experience designing buildings with structured parking?
Yes.
Okay.
The Salmon Bay building I just referred to as structured parking.
Okay. And then could you just summarize what was your understanding of the remand decision and what it instructed of the applicant in this case?
So we were instructed generally to look at the parking under the building and how the design standards required that as a mandatory requirement and how the applicant had been proposing that parking could or could not be integrated with the structure under the building.
Okay. And that would be related to Silverdale Design Standard. Is it 4.3 point D? Parking will be under building where feasible for multiple unit buildings.
Correct. That's the correct reference. And then also Silverdale Design Standards 242 existing surface parking lots will be reduced in area with more parking located in or under buildings. Et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. And the 9.4.3.D is specific to the waterfront district,
Yeah,
correct?
chapter 9 is specific to the waterfront district, and then chapter 2 is a more overall for the entire design standards area.
Okay. All right. So with those design standards in mind and with this location, when you're designing a building, how do those design standards impact the process?
So design standards are fundamental to where they exist. They're fundamental to the design process, and they have to come in at the very beginning. We often refer to that process of the project as pre-design because we're going to look at issues such as design standards as well as land use issues and other I'll say large scale issues that would impact the property, might be environmental concerns as well. Those types of issues have to be resolved early on. And in the case of a project that has a developer or an owner that is talking about a financial return, which was testified to yesterday, that owner of the de or that developer has to put together a pro forma that accommodates the requirements of the site. They will also have to put together a pro forma that considers, for example, the number of parking spaces, which might be both required by the land use code, but also might be required by their financial model or what they see as the right number of parking spaces for the market. They would have to consider setbacks. The land use code is going to be one of those things that's going to have the setbacks in it. They would have to consider impervious surface, which I believe they discussed yesterday. There's a variety of issues. All of those things would have to be baked into the project even before the architect or I would start, quote unquote, designing the project. We often prepare into aid this process. We often prepare very schematic block diagrams showing the disposition of parking on a site with the disposition of the building that would the parking would be serving. And of course, if they're linked, show how they would stack. And if they're not linked, show how both have room to fit on the site, how one would move around between parking and the intended use of the buildings. And you know, you find out with that early study often that not everything fits. Generally, I would say not everything fits. You don't get to build the maximum number of units that are allowed by the zoning code, and the minimum maximum number of parking spaces are allowed by the zoning code, just because the zoning code allows for it. It has to fit. It has to meet all the, you know, setbacks. It has to fit within environmental restrictions. It has to, and it just has to physically fit. And you know, the zoning code does not guarantee, far from it, that things will fit on any given parcel. So you go back and forth, you work with the owner and developer, figure out, well, can we deal with less parking spaces? Can we have 0.6 spaces per unit, for example? Or maybe the calculation is number square foot per space. Can we have 4 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet, or 5, or whatever the metric is? So parking is often a real challenge, and those parking requirements really come right at the beginning from the land use code design guidelines. Design guidelines very frequently have a lot of verbiage about how parking is handled.
If you were preparing the pro forma for this project with these design standards, would you have prepared a design that had parking under the structure?
Yes, because the code was very, and we're referring to the design standards, what it had the word will underneath it, and with the feasibility caveat. But in general, that's very strong language. Whenever I see will or shall in any of these types of land use documents, I take that as a requirement.
Right. And what are some of the other design considerations for this location in this district?
Well, as we have discussed, this is my third review of this project. and the project is, well, anyway, this is my third review of this project, and yet the design considerations remain the same. A lot of references to compatibility with the neighboring single family structures, emphasis on minimizing or eliminating surface parking lots, bringing cars around buildings towards the back, referencing the Old Town typology, which, as we've discussed in previous hearings, was about, you know, the shape of the buildings on the lot and their orientation to each other, and how they relate to a quote unquote town block scheme, you know, a standard scheme where you would have streets on a grid surrounding buildings. There's discussion of landscape, and how, again, as I said, how cars are brought in behind buildings and into these blocks. So,
okay. And what is, yes.
And I'm emphasizing parking in cars a little bit based on the remand, but there's other issues of character and design compatibility that, I don't believe an issue with today's hearing.
And generally, what are the purpose of some of these design considerations and these design standards? What is the purpose? What is the overall goal here?
Well, you want to try to enforce a certain quality of building, and I don't necessarily mean good, bad quality, although that's part of it. I mean the quality of the construction, how it matches or compares to or it's compatible with the surrounding community. If a community is a historic community, for example, or wants to preserve some historic
a little echo.
Not sure where that's coming from. Is it back better?
Yeah.
Okay. And if a community is historic or aspires to have a certain historic character, they might, put design standards on top of their existing land use code. Municipalities like Seattle and Bellevue, which I work in all the time, have design guidelines in particular neighborhoods where they're trying to add another layer of information and regulations for design professionals and developers to help them and hopefully ensure that, that neighborhood stays sort of on track with the character and the intended character and the intended urban or built environment that the community has come together through the comprehensive plan process and said that that's what they're trying to get out of their community or out of that particular neighborhood.
Okay. And in this case, so we have these design standards. How has the building design in this case changed to meet these buildings or these design standards over the course of, since you've been involved in 2020 and before?
Could I raise an objection? We seem to be straying into broader questions of design and the intent of the guidelines and the old town topography. Now, this is pretty limited to parking under building feasibility, and I feel like we're straying off, and it's going to take a lot longer if we redo the hearing we've already had twice.
You're muted.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, I was muted by the host, so okay, I'm back. So, Ms. Clinton, are you getting to the parking? I mean,
to parking. This was more of just the foundation of the role of the design standards and why it's important to consider these in your pro forma, the design of the site. And we're going to get into basically how the design has not changed.
All right. Okay. Overrule, but get to the parking. Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead. Right. So, back to my question for this project, how has the building design changed in order to better meet the design standards?
The building design hasn't really changed at all. There have been some minor cosmetic changes and addition of some planting to the one side of each of the buildings that's that are duplicates of each other. In regard to parking, at the building, there has been no change to how parking happens at the building. I believe at one point, I don't remember when, certain number of spaces were eliminated from the site, but it was a relatively small number.
Okay, so would it be accurate to say overall the project has not really changed since I think that it was originally proposed in 2018. Is that
right? And you would have to be an expert or somebody who had been on this case since 2018 to see any difference whatsoever in the proposals that we're still staring at in 2025.
So, in your experience, when you're designing a building and you run into some sort of issue where you need to adjust, is it relatively common to kind of redesign a project in a significant way?
Yes, especially at the stage of the project that this project seems to be fixed in a very early stage of design. There's not a, the drawings are, that have been presented are not very detailed and not have not been developed very far in terms of the architectural drawings. They're pretty early on. It's very easy at this point. It's truly lines on paper, as we say, for them to make adjustments to the building. And I would, it's very common to do so at this stage of the project.
Okay. But they haven't in this case.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. In your professional opinion, is parking under the building feasible for this site?
Yes.
And why is that?
So it's very common to construct buildings on podiums, which is for the purposes of today's conversation is a concrete structure that is a basic a garage, and it can be multiple stories or single story. It has a concrete lid or roof, and then a light frame structure is constructed on top of that, often made of wood framing. It could be light gauge sealed, depending on the contractor's preference, but typically it's wood frame, and it's a very common construction methodology in our region. The site is as I've testified before is extremely flat, gently sloping. I think was said yesterday. I think it makes it sound more sloping than it actually is. It's barely sloping enough for drainage, and there's plenty of height limits and room on the site for them to do the excavation necessary for during construction for constructing a garage, and there's plenty of room for them to build then a multi-story structure on top of the parking garage.
Right. So the design standards include this feasible language, right? We'll put parking on top of the buildings for multi-unit if feasible. Does this feasible language, you know, as an architect, if you were to run into this, does this feasible language imply that this requirement is somehow optional?
No, it doesn't. They have to show some sort of hardship, and because the feasible language is embedded in the specific waterfront district guidelines, Chapter 9 guidelines, the understanding for the people who wrote those guidelines, they knew that structured parking is a cost premium, because it's generally known that it is more expensive to build covered parking than it is to build uncovered parking, and so that should be assumed to already be baked into the cake. And any developer that would look at a site and see that language is in that waterfront district would know that financial, oh, it costs more, I can't do it. That doesn't hold. It doesn't hold water, so to speak. It's the intention of the design guidelines to effectively have the developer pay for and construct structured parking, and if they can't do that, then they need to build elsewhere.
And are there other things? So are there other things that they could do when designing a building that could improve the fees, that could sort of bake in those costs, right? Or help absorb some of those costs when building in the waterfront district?
Sure. I mean, they can limit how deep they go, which this applicant is motivated due to the aquifer. They can make the shape of the the structure as simple as possible, and the arrangement of the parking as close to being a simple double-loaded aisle, which we heard the word double-loaded corridor yesterday, but is similar but slightly different here. We're talking about cars, not people. But, you know, design a structure that is as simple and straightforward as possible, which this site very much allows for.
Okay. So in your opinion, this feasible doesn't mean just because it costs more means that it's optional, right?
Correct.
Okay. And in general, building construction, all of like, it costs a fair amount to build any apartment building, right?
Yeah.
Or any building for that matter.
You know, the developer, when they're building their pro forma, and they build the pro forma, you know, they need to not only evaluate the construction cost, which seems to be the only discussion point that was made in yesterday's testimony. They need to include rents. They need to improve some sort of, include some sort of capitalization rate. You know, how many years it's going to take to recover costs, what their timeline is for their investment. You know, the difference in investing in a building for 1 year versus 10-year outlook is huge. It makes a huge difference on whether a project is feasible or not.
And so there was a fair amount of discussion about, you know, these being this garden style being more affordable style of housing, which I believe is, you know, the developer's intent here. But is there any language in the design standards or code that say that based on the type of housing you're building that the standards don't apply?
No. In fact, I haven't word searched the land use code for garden style, but I just think that's something that certainly with the Silverdale design standards, it's not in there. That is just a sort of a real estate term.
Mm-hmm. And so in your opinion, are there other styles of buildings or other styles of apartment buildings that would be more feasible at this site, including this one? Let me rephrase that.
and style is a loaded term, right? I mean, we're not talking about Corinthian or Ionic or something like that. I mean, there's infinite ways to arrange living units around circulation pathways. The double-loaded corridor was the one we were discussing. The applicant was discussing yesterday. I wouldn't call it a style of a building, but it's a common floor plan arrangement.
Okay. And so in this discussion of feasibility, I believe the definition for feasibility is capable of being done, right?
Yes.
And so in this case, with this site, do you feel like you could design a building where it is capable of having structured parking under the building?
Mm-hmm. I do. Again, this site is pretty, it lends itself very well to structured parking.
And it doesn't say capable being done based on a particular design or a particular price point that the developer would intend, right?
It does not.
Okay. All right. So the applicant, the testimony claimed that basically parking under the building is not feasible for a number of reasons. So I kind of want to just dive into each on its own. So let's start with the argument that it would require the building to be deeper. They claim basically parking under the building would require going anywhere from 6 to 12 feet deeper. What's your response to that?
It's not true. It's overstated. It just demonstrates the fact that they continue to put forth exact same design that they started with in 2018 or 2019, whenever we first started looking at this, and they do some sort of brute force logic of saying why that building that they designed in 2018 doesn't work on this site for the depth once you had parking is is not how we design, not how competent designers and engineers work. And it doesn't reflect the reality that it's, again, there's plenty of room and height limit on the site to allow for structured parking.
Excuse me, may I lodge an objection? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm a little concerned about the witness going beyond his expertise. I've heard that he's well, we heard his qualifications. I haven't heard that he either has the background to testify to structural engineering, or that his opinion is based upon having consulted with a structural engineer. I feel like his testimony is being argumentative at this point, and he lacks the foundation to offer all of his opinions in this regard. He can testify to architectural issues, but I don't know whether he can voice an opinion, or I haven't heard the foundation for an opinion regarding the additional 6 to 12 feet of depth that was testified to yesterday, and that is foundational to, no pun intended, literally, to this issue.
Right, Ms. Clemson, you want to address that?
I would say that a lot of these issues that he's about to testify to were also addressed by Mr. Miller, who was similarly an architect and did not establish. We didn't require him to have the structural engineering background. And also, I would say these architects regularly work with structural engineers in the design, so I think he has enough of a knowledge base to be able to speak to that.
I'm sorry, but yet the difference yesterday is that those experts called by the applicant were in consultation with one another. There's never a question that Mr. Miller was in touch with at least the structural engineer who testified. So we're untethered at this point because we don't have engineering evidence being proffered by the appellant.
Mr. Adams, you want to, well, I mean, Ms. Clemson, you want to just question Mr. Adams about his background on the structural engineering aspects of his testimony?
Mr. Adams, could you give us a little bit of background about your knowledge or your professional experience with structural engineers as part of your job as an architect?
Sure. First of all, as a licensed architect, I am legally allowed to perform engineering, quote unquote, services. But I'll concede the point that I can typically use a structural engineer when designing buildings. However, I have to understand in detail how the building is engineered, and what is pertinent to this particular case is how large and therefore deep in this case, or wide, or what the physical disposition in space all of the structural elements have. Because I have to design with the structural engineer or do engineering, if I were to do engineering myself, that meets the spatial requirements, because the engineers, for example, don't care if somebody bonks their head on the floor up above because they've engineered it and it's solid. I have to care about that somebody doesn't bonk their head on the floor structure above. So what we're talking about here, when we're talking how deep the building is a spatial issue. And the structural engineering is actually not at question. I don't question that they have to have foundations. Of course they do. I'm acutely aware of how foundations work. That is part of my training, and that's part of what I'm licensed for. So the presumption that I'm just painting buildings with colors and making them pretty shapes, and I'm sure that's not exactly what you're saying, Mr. Walker, but I have to have a deep understanding of how structures work, what structural opportunities present themselves in any particular building and site, and then how to make that work with the overall spatial relationships of the whole building.
Okay. Yeah, I'll overrule. I mean, I think the issue goes, well, it's more of a weight issue, and I'm sure that opposing counsel will bring some of that out in cross-examination. But I do think that Mr. Adams has works a lot with structural issues, and that at least has some you know, architect level understanding of how those issues are supposed to work. So go ahead, Ms. Clungeon.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Thank you.
Okay. So getting back to the discussion about whether the building would have the whether the foundation would have to go deeper into the earth in order to support structured parking. What is your response to that?
So the question of whether the foundation would have to go deeper is whether or not you can locate the foundation at a height that is at or above the safe level for the aquifer. And spatially, I believe it is possible to take even the thicker foundation system that is proposed and still fit that additional depth of the foundation above the line or at the same line of the original, what they call the original impact in their diagrams.
All right. And so I want to bring up, this is Appellant Exhibit A8, which are some of the plan drawings where they were the applicant's plan drawings and then yours your additions as well. So let me share my screen. You know when it's up. For some reason it's
coming.
Doesn't want
got
to.
The black screen.
Okay. All there right. Okay, great. Are you able to see it?
Yes.
Not quite yet. But that might be my issue. Hold on 1 second.
Okay,
I see it now. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I just want to get that up. All right, so can you show us on these drawings that you prepared how the parking doesn't, or the structure doesn't, the foundation doesn't need to be lower?
Can you see me drawing? I just want to make sure.
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. And Mr. Examiner, I'll try to be descriptive for the record if I draw anything. This drawing has two parts, a left side and a right side. The left side is from the applicant's brief, I believe, the pre-hearing brief. And the right side is my extraction from their diagram for a little bit of clarity, showing the original proposal, as they call it, or the current design, they call it. So on the left, they've highlighted in red or pink, however your eyes work, the shape of the current design or the original proposed design. It's something like this, which I'm highlighting their drawing. I have replicated that shape at the same level on the right-hand side of this document and elaborated on slightly to show that I've lined it up as best I possibly can with their diagram. There is a heavy red dashed line on the right-hand side labeled floor level 2 at high side grade. You'll see that line matches up with the gray line that they show in red next to their building on their side of the this document. When I scale their drawing using all the available dimensions that they have provided on their document, I can demonstrate that the floor height, which is 9 feet, extends to the bottom of their diagram, which is the red line at the bottom of their red outline or pink outline. So getting to something that was brought up yesterday, I focused in on the corner of the lower right-hand corner of their red line, and they are showing that is to be the height of the impact of this, excuse me, the depth of the impact of their original design. That is, however, also, as I just demonstrated, their 9-foot floor-to-floor height. So they have failed to include room for a foundation, which would be, I'll redraw that, excuse me. They would fail to include a foundation that would go underneath that corner of the building, in fact, either corner of the building. So I have added that foundation on the right-hand side and labeled that foundation, missing foundation, lower than indicated original proposed impact. They've also shown this original proposed impact line on their side where they labeled original proposed impact, and it's a dashed green or cyan line. Can't quite make out what color that is there. And I'm not sure they would have to explain. I'm not sure why that line is sloping, but that line is sloping much steeper than the typical grade across the site, which is implied by their grade line to the left of their existing building in magenta and their grade line to the right of the building in magenta, which I've replicated here. So already the diagram is unfortunately full of a lot of logical errors, and the depth at which they're saying their impact is proposed is artificially too high. It should be at least as low as the depth of the foundation that they would propose on their current design. So that immediately takes a certain number of feet off of the analysis here, or at least we can't trust this diagram to have any accuracy whatsoever, and should dismiss it as some sort of, you know, pretty picture, but not really actually showing anything that we can rely on for how deep this proposed garage that they're showing really might end up being.
So I want to go back to more talking about why it would need to be the 6 to 12 feet deeper, right? So one of the reasons being that they claim the garage ceiling would need to be thicker, right?
Mm-hmm.
All that.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your response to that?
So they need to design this. To just say the entire ceiling of the garage is thicker because there's beams doesn't actually get into the an appropriate level of design understanding of, like, how do these beams, are they everywhere? Are they just at certain segments between certain column lines? How many columns are there? Can they make the columns denser at certain areas so they can have shallower beams, which is typical more columns, shallower beams? Can they use alternative construction structures, which are extremely common, such as post-tension slabs that have no beams whatsoever? It's a question of design, and they have never shown, this is the first cross-section that I'm aware of that they've shown that begins to show the relationship of the vertical floor dispositions of, in this case, the parking garage. They're not, of course, not showing any detail of anything above the parking garage. So, you know, but this only shows an infinitely thin plane through the building. It does not show the disposition of all the beams throughout the building, throughout the parking structure, how many columns there are. We don't know any of this information, and they haven't provided that information at all.
Okay. So you mentioned there are methods to reduce the thickness, or that we just also don't have adequate information here in this design. Is that accurate?
Correct.
Okay.
There are concrete floor structures that have the equivalent thickness of the wood floor structure that would be typically between the residential floor to floors that are no thicker than those wood floor structures. By virtue of the fact that the concrete has a great deal more strength in it than wood frame structures, you can design some pretty thin concrete structures.
In addition to, that said it would need to be deeper, could it go wider instead of deeper in order to absorb that additional load of the structure and the residences on top?
Yep. For example, you have where we had we were building next to Salmon Bay in Seattle. We were on the old Marco Shipyard site. It was a contaminated site, and the Salmon Bay was a couple feet below the level of the building. We had to do a variety of techniques, but fundamentally a raft foundation type system that allowed the building to utilize the entire width of the structural slab as a foundation, if you will, as opposed to relying on just simply these narrow lines of foundation that are shown in this diagram, or at least applied in this diagram.
How much does adding sprinklers impact the height in a structured parking garage?
So it depends. Again, this is something that needs to be designed. You do not have a absolute volume of this whole zone of the building from 3 foot up to 5 feet or 6 feet or whatever is 100% full of sprinkler pipes. We've all been in parking garages. We look up, we see the sprinkler pipes. There's some big ones, there's some small ones. And so the small ones can be very close to the ceiling, within less than a foot away from the ceiling, and the big ones might need to be further away, but those can be located along column lines or against walls, and where they're out of the way of any van stall parking, which was brought up as the driving factor for the height of a garage. Absolutely, you have to provide room for that ADA height requirement for a van. But you don't have to put the big main sprinkler main right over the drive aisle where the van enters the building, and you don't have to put that big sprinkler main right over the van stall. You can design these things so that you avoid these problems.
Okay. And but even if they say a sprinkler does add a little bit of space and an additional the foundation might need to be a little bit thicker or a ceiling might need to be a little bit thicker than previously, is there any reason why those measurements couldn't be sent upwards instead of downwards toward the aquifer?
No, once you it, there's no reason. Once you tighten up, sharpen your pencil, we say, figure out a good layout that makes everything fit, and we're still a little bit deep. In this case, you get the benefit of being able to push the building up a few feet, and it wouldn't make you add 2 feet to the height of this building on this site, and it would not, in my opinion, make a material difference to the design, especially since the applicant has shown this 5 foot tall parapet wall that I still don't understand, that it was in that exhibit that came off the screen, that is just adding height to the building for almost no functional reason whatsoever.
So say you were to, keep the if you were to keep the bottom of the foundation the same, and maybe now you need an elevator pit, right? Maybe it's a couple of feet or something, but you change it. But if you were to, you can subtract some of that height from the parapet, right?
Yep, you could.
So the building could go up a little bit and still ultimately be the same size, not go any farther down into the aquifer and
Sure.
accommodate parking under the structure. And the units proposed, right?
It seems absolutely totally reasonable and totally possible based on my analysis. The applicant needs to actually demonstrate in some meaningful accurate way, which that cross section did not do, why it doesn't work.
Okay. And what about the argument that, you know, people aren't going to want to walk up four flights of stairs as a reason for why they don't need to put parking out of the building?
Well, then they then provide an elevator if they feel that they're going to be able to lease units better, then the cost of the elevator will pay for itself.
And why is that?
Because then they're going to be able to command higher rents. They're going to be able to serve a larger community. Currently, despite some, I assume, mistaken testimony, probably in good faith, but mistaken testimony from Mr. Miller yesterday, there's only 25% of these units are accessible. So all of a sudden now with an elevator service, you have 100% of units being accessible. And that doesn't mean just people in wheelchairs. That means all kinds of folks that just might not want to use stairs, don't feel comfortable with stairs. Maybe they have some arthritis or gout, and they hate going up and down stairs all the time. And they're going to use the elevator. Absolutely. So now you expanded the number of people you could, who would be interested in renting your spaces. But 75% and more of your units are accessible by those folks.
Ms. Clemson, we're at the break time. Do you want to take a break now or go a little further?
Yeah, we can take a break now. Thank you.
Okay. We'll see you at 2:45.